It must be a very critical moment.
Better now. there are many things when I won't go out of the reality of the story because several things are already talking to me. Let's just stick with this. So when he heard this voice, the paraphrase of that and his explanation was that it's not a straight narration. There are many aspects of it, but he gets a gestalt of it all, which seemed to say that only dragon can help you. There are many, many dragons. He was very learned. He knew all these different names of the dragons, the relatives of the dragons, the children of the dragons when he mated with different animals. He knew all about that. He knew the Tao Te, the Makara, the thing we talk about, the Chi Wei, the dragon, the animal on the music instrument at the feet of the bathtub, at the entrance of the city gate on top of the roof. He knew all of that. But he was very sure that the message meant that each dragon has his specific function. And since this man, that is he, wants total wisdom, total knowledge, any partial dragon, any specialized dragon will not do. It may not only mislead him on his journey and pilgrimage to truth, it may mislead him and in fact endanger his life. And he was very clear of that message. And at that time, he began to look for dragons. The day that he was walking down the village street, that was one of the very early days when he first got the message about his dragon. And he knew he will have to wait for something that's really magnificent, really great. And that very first one he saw was so great that he couldn't believe his luck. He felt that, how could it be that the first one I saw is as magnificent as this one? It was a blue one. It was a big, long one, swimming in that way. Actually, it was flying in the sky without wings, very leisurely making the turns above the village. And he caught hold of that by noticing something, some light blinking in the dusk of the evening, and it was the eyes of the dragon, and the dragon was looking at him. What was he doing then? He was among some other villagers. And these other villagers and he were enjoying an evening snack, a wonton peddler. They sell wonton by having a portable stove on one end and all the ingredients on the other end carry from a pole on the shoulder of the peddler. And on this light, there is a little red cloth-covered lantern at the end, which serves as advertisement also as a working light. So he ordered a bowl of wonton soup, still hot in his hand, and he has his chopsticks in the other hand, having a good company with the other villagers. And then he had to see from the corner of his eye this descending dragon. And the dragon was fixing his eyes on him, and he knew this time he had to be very sure, so he dodged behind his door and hid himself behind one of these two doors and looking out at the door from between the door jamb and the door. And the dragon lowered his body down. And of course, the village street is not all that wide, so he could not really wind around too easily. But the dragon was very determined. Even though his tail is still up in the sky, the body is already down and looking for him. Somehow missed seeing the fact that he had dodged behind that door, but the man was there looking at it and said, "Oh, this is it. It's such a magnificent thing. Look at the scale, look at the horn, look at the whiskers, and look at the claws, and those brilliant eyes and energy inside it." But he wanted to be very sure. He has been a very careful research scholar. He's going to look at all these details. He, of course, thought this one in a million chance that the first one is this genuine one, but this one looks like the one in the paintings, the one looks like the one in the embroideries. And the dragon came around every time, would pass the door closer and looking at him and looking at him. Finally, it decided that is the man hiding behind there, and put his nose right at this crack between the door jamb and the door, and blowing this hot air right to his face, and he was on this other side. And he said, well, I have no time. I need time to decide. I don't think the dragon can get at me. After all, on my doors, I have just pasted the new door guards, and they are there to protect me with their weapons. And then the second thought, as most scholars do, they have their doubts, he said, but you see, this funny-looking door guards could have been a distant relative, like the sixth person 20 times removed from the dragon, and he will side with the dragon and may surrender me. And he was in a terrible fix. It was at that moment he didn't lose his cool. He looked at those two nostrils, he recognized them. He said, these are the nostrils of the horse. This is a horse dragon, not the perfect dragon. The moment the thought appeared in his head, the dragon felt very sheepish, you know, identified. He shrank a little bit and he rose, but as he left, the waving of his tail still exhibits kind of dignity that he did have, but he was identified. So he came out very triumphantly from behind his door and looking at all his village friends. And all the village friends were with their mouths wide open looking at him, as if he was a monster. He said, you know, that nobody look at him. Nobody saw the dragon. From that time on, he doesn't bother to tell his friends what he has been looking for and what he saw. There are many of these encounters. And one particular one was a dragon with wings. And it was a very dangerous one. It got big beaks. And not only it comes, it announces its appearance by knocking his upper and lower beak so loudly, chop, 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 like this, these horny beaks, and with very sharp points. And he didn't have time to even negotiate with this dragon. He quickly dodged underneath the bed. And then this big thing with his wind puffing, kicking up all the dust, looking for him under the bed. So he shouted at the top of his lungs that, you are nothing but a scavenger eagle dragon. I know who you are. And the eagle dragon found out, but he still had the chance. He wanted to swipe at him, but he was far enough inside, and reluctantly it left. The true Chinese Taotie dragon with this tiger face came up also. And this was another time. It came, it was a very learned, very severe, almost like a judge of the other world, with his big mouth, powerful muscle at his cheekbone, and come here and very frankly just want to eat him up, just want to swallow him. And he knew by this time, he has experienced many other dragons in between, that somehow they all found out that here is someone who wants a dragon, and they have something that they want out of him, and there's really nothing he wants out of them, so have to be very careful. But so this man, this big tiger dragon came, approached him in the frontally, with the upper jaw and no lower jaw, and was ready to come close. And he knew, he said, you are a Taotian, no doubt. But all the time in the illustrations and in the artwork, we see you in the frontal way. So they are known as a mask. And today I have a good chance to see your profile, even see your hind view. You know, as a scholar, he's interested in knowing about all this. And this tiger dragon, knew about that, was quite respectful as to his learnedness. And he somehow would like to swallow him, body and learnedness and all, in one big gulp. Then decided probably it was not quite the right thing to do, and nodding his huge head in approval, and he turned around and left, giving him the hind view and everything for him to see. Of all the dragons that he really loved, he has a warm spot in his heart for, was a deer dragon. This time, he had gone out of this human habitation of a village, of society, to look for it in the mountains, because he knew a dragon sometimes exhibits itself in the war formation of an army. How this one army is arranged in such a way it can swallow the other army. Or sometimes the mountain range exhibit the form of a dragon. It can either foster a prosperous city or it can house the tomb of a king. And he went to the mountain to look for the real dragon. This time he went quite far out of his village. You must remember now, before modern time, a villager doesn't really travel more than 30 miles or so from where he is. He traveled into a little mountain range, somewhere he never explored it before, and he found it something very beautiful. He got the right feeling, and there was a fine stand of forest, and in between the tree trunks, he could even see a clearing on the far side, and then the forest beyond that. And in that clearing here and there, there are deer. And then somewhere is a forest lake and giving it a little more light. And beautiful deer, 30, 40 in a group, and they enjoy their feeding. They run a little race with each other now and then. And then once in a while, a group of stag was parade together as if in some kind of a ritual. And you will see the antlers just above the shrubbery in the field. And he felt very, very good. Such a paradise of the deer. Such a nice enclosure in the dragon of the mountains. And he didn't want to disturb it. He stood on the edge of the forest admiring this. And then deep inside that clearing, a huge pair of antlers rose and was full of fuzzy growth, and it was big, and it keep coming up until they come to midway of the trunks of the tree just under the crown of the leaves, and underneath that is the big head of his stag. And then following that was a long body of the deer dragon. It goes around for a long while, and then the moment it rises in the air, it starts to move, pulsating, and beginning to weave its way among the trees. He's doing that to assure his own deer, don't be afraid, he was there. And indeed, some of the deer were stood still wherever they found themselves, looking at this great deer dragon. Some other was run close to the deer dragon and looked back at the stranger, saying that we have a visitor. And then he was also reassuring the stranger that he wanted him to have time to see their place, to see their citizens, to see himself before he would come out and greet him. There was no need for that. He was already in love with this place. He just find this is beautiful. And then when that mental message is transmitted to the dragon came straight at him and out of the forest and rose even higher, just circulating in the air with his head not moving, looking down fondly in friendship at him. And he fell back and he sat on the grass and cross-leggedly, the two of them facing each other for a long while, full of understanding, full of love. And he felt that he didn't have to have any more dragon, even though this is an impartial dragon. Yes, this is a partial dragon, it's a deer dragon. And he behaved so differently. He never tried to hide his identity. He had nothing asked of him. He was there, and he was very proud of being the way he is, and very glad to have made a friend. But his mission does not end here. When it was dark, he has to go back to his place in time. He kind of said goodbye to all the deer and to his new friend, and he started his way out of the forest. And the dragon followed him. And by the time he came to the edge of the foothills and said goodbye and went back to his herd, and he never told this to anyone. He actually never told about his encounters to anybody. Now come to the time when he was about 60. And this day was his 60th birthday. And he felt very, very at peace after he had met the deer dragon. He knew that if he never saw the real dragon, his problems already solved. But if the real dragon should really come, he should do justice to that opportunity, to that offer, something that the whole history never related to anyone having given that kind of a favor. To keep himself busy, he went to the field, being late spring, that much to do. The forest, his crop had just been planted. He just go there to do a little weeding. the field looks kind of bare because the vegetation are so low. It was a fine day, bright, sunny. Somehow he spotted a speck of dark cloud on the far horizon. And that little dark cloud was moving. And he knew this time. He doesn't even have to ask anyone to tell what kind of a horn it had, nostril he had, and scales or not. He knew that little thing is a dragon, and it's coming at him. He said, I better go to the higher point and have a closer look. As he was going to the high point on this yellow dirt road, that little speck of dark cloud has developed into a storm cloud, rising up in a big head with its tail end still etching the ground on the horizon. And this thing moves closer. It has no form. It has nothing but energy inside. It could be the outline of a flight of birds or a school of fish or an army in movement or a pilgrim going to some holy places. Somehow there's nobody organizing it, and together they become one life form. This cloud is coming close. Whatever it covered, the things disappear into darkness. He ducked underneath that high-flying cloud. He can still see on the ground level to the horizon. The little tail end is still on the horizon. So the whole distance between him and the horizon is this one thing, this big new dragon. And then, before he knew it, that little opening below the dragon and the horizon closed up. The dragon stopped right in front of him. Here he is, looking at the horizon, and all these things from one end to the other, from horizon to horizon this way, is one black wall, and then from ground to sky. And with this, he noticed that something has indeed give him the total and the complete time and space of this other reality right next to him. He listened into it. There's kind of a pulsating sound like breathing. And this breathing began to harmonize with his, or he began to harmonize his breathing with that, and he's beginning to lose his mind. He's beginning to be sucked into it, inviting into it. And yes, there's nothing sinister about that. The whole thing is like a very lively, very healthy animal, but it could be just a little kitten purring there and falling asleep. He looked at this darkness, and he couldn't decide what to do. And being an investigative scholar, of course, he thought of an idea. He said, suppose this is not that wide open jaw showing the dark interior of the dragon, but indeed a black wall separating this and the other world. In that case, if I pick up a pebble and throw at it, it will bounce back. Then it proves something. As to what, he wasn't quite clear, like all research start that way. Suppose he pick up the pebble, throw it, and it went in. That's even more interesting, meaning there's space over there, but again, it doesn't really prove anything. It might, in fact, irritate the dragon. And then if so, if the dragon indeed wants to take him down in a gulp, you know, there's no chance for him to escape anyhow. So the thought, you know, is overtaken by the action. He already picked up a pebble, and he threw it. He saw clearly the light that shines on this pebble diminish as the pebble crossed that dark, thin line. It became half a pebble and a little bit of a pebble and disappeared. It disappeared into darkness. And the dragon, breathing as usual, not disturbed. He said, I just tested whether there's space there. I have not tested the temperature inside there. Suppose it is indeed, you know, in one of the symbolism of that is the gate of hell. You can can see that in the Saint-Étienne at Caen or the Amiens Cathedral. This would be very hot. He said, what can I do to find out about that? So he picked up his slipper. He said, if I toss his slipper in, and if it's actually very hot, as we were told by our books, it will catch on fire. And if it catches on fire, I'll see fire, I'll see light into that darkness. And that was a good idea. Before he finished that sentence, the slipper went. The slipper went the same way, from light to become dark and then disappear. No fire. He said, I've been concentrating on vision. I've neglected the audio, you see. I never heard the pebble land, and I did not hear my slipper land. Out comes the second slipper, went into that thing. No sound, not a stir. So this is a little too much. He decided, all right, this is indeed the entrance to the other world, so big from horizon to horizon, from heaven to earth. But what's lying across, following the contour up and down of the land, sometimes even half a house over there is a farmhouse, must be then the lower lip of this all-swallowing dragon. The upper lip is as high as the sky. Always we are looking into it. We are always underneath the upper lip like that. So this must be the lower lip. If this is the case, why don't I dig down a little? If I get underneath over the lower lip, I can even lift it to see whether the land is still on the other side, that the world is not cut off, that become a precipice from this point over. So he start to find a stronger stick and start digging. No matter how deep he digs, the shadow come down to match it. Perfectly, there's no gap. In other words, whatever you can conceive, that space is within the ability of the dragon to take. But when he was digging, he observed one thing. Once in a while, he poked too hard. The stick actually passed that line. And he saw with his own eyes that with his rhythmical movement of digging, he was able to pull the stick back out again. And he looked at the stick, he said, if this is the case, another experiment I must do as a prudent scholar before I do anything hasty. He go and look for a fairly strong, long stick. He's not going to poke the dragon like a musketeer. He said, the thing to do is to toss this stick with measured force so that it will land on the ground half in, half out. And I can pull it back out. He tossed this stick in, and the long stick became a short stick right there. He found it very delighted. It almost deserved writing a special paper with a lot of footnotes to publish that. So he bent down and pulled that stick, and he pulled it out. The whole thing came out, not an inch short, no scorched mark, no chewed mark. He said, now there's only one thing left to do to get in there. But make sure you do not just walk headlong into it. The fact that I can get the stick out is because I left one half of the stick out. Now, what part of the body I should go in there and take a look? Of course, you should take your head in because then you can take a look. But, you know, it's too important. And he has two hands. By this age, toiling all his life, and he's getting a little arthritic. And his left hand is like this, and his right hand is better. And he does his writing with his left hand. So he made up his mind before he really made up his mind. His emotion already pours out to the faithful old left hand and feel very sorry about him and said, you know, you are going to be it. But I will try it with one finger instead of the whole hand. And so he went with that finger and he made up his mind and he quickly put it out. And he saw that his finger became short and became long again, and there was no sensation. He felt very good about this. He said, His hand was in it. He felt around, and then nothing was there. He didn't see his hand. His hand's up to here. After doing this for a while, he went in further, and he went as far as his shoulder, like that. And this way, he discovered two things. The fact that he has his arm raised all this time, he did not feel the usual fatigue. And then when he was moving his fingers around, he had never been able to move his fingers that well in years. Something just euphorious about that is just beautiful on the other side. So he said, perhaps I ought to go in with a little more. The thing to do is to test the ground, whether there's anything to step on. If so, he can transfer his weight back and forth. But before that is proven, he better put all his weight on his hind leg, and he beginning to lower his body and reach out with his toe. And at this time, he has one hand in it also. There was no bottom. This is very dangerous. He can very easily fall into it. But with very good sensitive and a cool head, of course, he noticed that you do not have to support your weight on the other side. I hate to make a summary. It means that all the sensations, all the things we call reality, is the opposite over there. So there's nothing at gravity. There's nothing at weight. But he didn't quite come to that conclusion. He decided to put his head in this time to take a good look, seeing his weight is supported by his hind leg. So now he has two arms and his head into that thing. Total darkness. Even that breathing disappeared, become total quietness. So that what he was hearing was the reality of this side. Inside there is complete nothingness. He tried to turn his head back and look at the lighted side of the real world. He couldn't see that. Total darkness. He couldn't even be sure he still had eyes. However, in his mind's eye, he could see half of his body in light. It must be a very funny sight. He thought, all those silly farmers must be laughing their head off. Here I'm without a head. And he moved his weight into his other foot and leave his other one, the only one, halfway in the air behind. He said, that is something for them to look at. And he was very pleased with himself. He's feeling good, he's happy, and he's feeling everything is safe. And then there's no reason for him not to pull that last leg in. So he starts slowly putting that last leg in. He could see that his knee disappeared, his calf disappeared, his ankle disappeared, and then even his toes, just the ball, the heel of his bare foot there like a ball in the lighted air, and then he pulled that in. The moment he was completely in, light resumed. Everything became normal. He found himself standing in the middle of the same road with all the farmers going about their work, with the forest, with the houses, with the trees, and the dark clouds has disappeared, and he doesn't even have anything to prove. He looked in front of him, there's a stick, there's a pebble, and his pair of slippers. He went on, he put on his slippers, he looked at his fellow villager, said nothing, took a long walk to unwind, and went home. And that was his 60th birthday. Thank you very much. The oral tradition should have many, many versions, and this is somewhat different from the one in River Styx number 8. I first published this in Chinese in 1976, February. I checked that out. It was to celebrate the Year of the Dragon. And The copies are available. If I to tell the story again, it will be a total story, a total different story. I know the time is a little late, and I want to serve up a little dessert. And this dessert doesn't even have a story. It has a visual experience. It has emotional content. It has the intellectual challenge. And it is called the Tiger Girl. And it's a very short one. I go out like this. Again, back into the time when scholarship is for its own sake, and it was a kind of an insuppressible urge to understand. And there are many people, after they have the ability to take care of their biological and sociological affairs, they become the wandering scholars who want to search for wisdom, for knowledge, for answers to their questions. The Tiger Girl was somewhat with a little root in the folk tale that there are people who are not people, who are animals. And this part of my cosmic stories have also translated, but not published in English yet. They enjoy the companionship of human beings so that they can share the excitements that other animals don't have, that is, the intellectual excitements. And here was one day, the scholar, the wandering scholar, was going through the countryside when he came to a village nested in the valley, and there's a clear brook in front of the village, and there are some girls washing, doing the laundry. And he somehow felt a little kind of attracted to one of them, and he stood very politely to one side, and without any overt approach, he admired this particular girl. And this girl somewhat noticed him, and delayed her return to the village with all her sisters and siblings, and she went on doing more laundry until all the other girls have left. And the scholar felt that and she must be noticing me and appropriate for him to go on and talk to this girl, and said, I'm a wandering scholar, and this come to your place for the first time, and I wonder whether you have enjoy a moment with me. Well, and all the other story I've told you, in St. Louis, I've written and published, and this is one in the germination period. In other words, they formed a team together, and she traveled with him and through big cities, small cities, countries, temples, Taoist priests, and lectures, and so on. And she took very good care of him. And before she met him, he met her. His clothing is always dirty. His bedroll is full of lice, and he never ate his meal on time, and so forth. Now with this girl traveling with him, and she see to that his clothes gets washed, and his socks get darned, and the food will be bagged from the villages and prepared in a tasty way. So he feel very comfortable and beginning to feel that he's going closer and closer to the understanding of the meaning of the elusive happiness. He gets his best creative thought on philosophy at night. That is, when they lie down under the stars to pass the night, and he would turn away from her, looking out to the horizon, whatever night light there still is, and he would reel off this profound philosophy, sometimes in prose, sometimes in verse, and it was just beautiful. It is almost too much of a shame for stories like that and for literature and philosophy like that to be said to the forest, to the trees and the animals. But he wasn't. He had an appreciative companion behind him. At this time, she was always there, very faithfully and very gently and skillfully scratching his back. What he doesn't know, and all of us don't know, but only I know, is that in the story here, this girl is a tiger girl, was not a common human being. And the tiger girl turned herself, after thousands of years of doing tapas, which is a religious term of accumulating credit in spiritual cultivation, would be able to turn herself into a human being. But sometimes not complete, and sometimes under pressure, under stress, or under great excitement, she would reverse back to a tiger. And when she's reversed back to a tiger, she assumes all the tiger nature and tiger characteristics. So when he is getting better and better, and they went travel farther and farther, and every night when she moved, and he became inspired and was doing his discourse in philosophy with her scratching his back, and he will become more and more like a great thinker of the time, and the tiger girl would feel more and more she has indeed found the human being to serve. And she will first change back to tiger where her paws are, and this big powerful claws will be scratching him. And at this time his emotion elevated, this little more rougher and tougher and wounding kind of scratching just soothed him fine, so he talked about even greater things and more vehemently. And then the tiger girl will turn into a tiger, and then with his tail whipping back and forth, even making noises, knocking down small trees, and nothing to disturb him, and he was there talking more about his profound thoughts. And then at this time, the head of the tiger girl will become bigger. Now these are quite related to the dragon story, and he would, this tiger is it now, it's not he or she. It would then very lovingly and drooling over the head of the scholar. His mouth would open bigger and bigger and scratching harder and make him talk more and measure up to see whether it's big enough to swallow the scholar in one gulp without hurting him. And the scholar would be waving his hands so she has, or it has to stretch his mouth even bigger. And it's a combination of the tiger and the serpent. So the tiger unlocks the jawbone and become enormously large. And if at this time the hapless scholar thought of seeking some approval, seeking some admiration, should turn back and say, "How did you like what I said?" or "How did you like my last paper?" The embarrassed tiger had no choice but to maul him and kill him. But if the scholar is so good, so perfectly good, qualified to be the greatest thinker of his time, ready to join who's who in his society, then the tiger girl's mouth will be so big and swallow him whole, and the world never hear from him again. And the legend will say that he indeed had found truth. And that is the end of the tiger girl. But the tip end of the tiger girl, you know, these dragon stories are is the leopard girl. I had planned to finish with the leopard girl today. You don't have much chance to see tiger girls. And this is the endangered species, and the one left are all in the zoo. But the leopards, some of them in different ways, are still available. And many of them make up the lack of tiger. They have done their toughest, and they have changed themselves into beautiful ladies, and they mix in cocktail parties. And after a few drinks, they may turn into lepers. But you should spot them first. And the greatest secret, and this is something not to leave this room, all of you have to swear to me that your confidence, keep this in your own head. The only way to tell a leopard girl in a crowded cocktail party, no matter what costume, no matter which way she shows up, sometimes very brilliant, sometimes very dumb, sometimes deliberately messy, never look at her in the eye. Always look at the girls that you meet at the cocktail party sideways, in a perfect profile. Always look at her that way. The normal human girl will have what you are familiar with, the profile either drawn by Angel or Michelangelo. That's where the eye is capable of disappearing under the eyelid when the eye is closed. But the leopard has a round eye. It bulges out. Its special eyelid will cover it too. But to tell the leopard girl's eye from a human eye is that to see from the side, You don't see the pupils and everything, just like in every other eye, but a transparent, glassic dome that comes outside of that. And look very carefully. When you see them, you make up your mind. You can go and approach her, and you may have quite an experience. But if we don't hear from you anymore, you know what happened. Thank you very much.